This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The story of water contaminated with PFOA has been unfolding in parts of Bennington County, Vermont, and Rensselaer County, New York, for a couple of months. But the earliest suspicions that something might be in the water actually came from residents in affected towns long before that. The sources of PFOA have been traced to manufacturing plants near the contaminated water sources. In Hoosick Falls, New York, a local doctor and a man who lost his father to cancer stand out as two people who forced local officials to deal with the issue. In North Bennington, Vermont, housing developer Jim Goodine regrets that he didn't work harder to make his suspicions heard.
You know, I'm a carpenter. For me to try to second guess, these are big guys, you know. These were big industrialists. They have factories in different places, and they show up in, you know, Brooks Brothers suits, and you feel intimidated by people like that. And in hindsight, I'm kicking myself as hard as I can. I feel horrible. I feel partly responsible for the fact that I did not go to the state and say, you have to do something here. You have to find out what's going on. And I wish now that I had pursued this as far as I possibly could. But at the time, it seemed like, wow, this is a big company. They're pushing back hard. They're threatening me with lawyers. I just backed off.
And local resident Carol Moore says it was the actions of people in New York State that made her sound an alarm to Vermont officials. Her letter to the state is credited with getting the water testing started in Bennington County.
I was so inspired by the Hoosick Falls residents, and I watched just remarkable, ordinary people doing amazing things, becoming experts in PFOA, becoming water angels, taking water to residents, and that was the tipping point for me. I felt that I could do that too. I just knew that the word needed to get out.
These are just two of thousands of people in southwestern Vermont and adjacent New York State whose lives have been caught up in the problem of PFOA. The suspected carcinogen got into drinking water from manufacturing processes over decades. And now local, state, and federal officials, along with citizens and the factory owners themselves, are trying to clean up the water and figure out what impact PFOA has had on human health over the years that it went unnoticed in drinking water. On Thursday, we learned another Vermont town, Pownal, is also affected. And today on Vermont Edition, we're going to look at how the PFOA problems in New York and Vermont were detected and how far the problem might extend. We're joined now by two reporters who've spent a lot of time looking into this issue. Howard Weiss-Tisman is a reporter for VPR in southern Vermont. He's been covering the PFOA contamination in Bennington County. Howard, nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Jane.
Brendan Lyons is a senior writer for the Times Union in Albany, assigned to the investigative team. He's been covering the PFOA contamination in Hoosick Falls, New York. Brendan, thank to you for being here as well.
You bet. My pleasure.
Let's start with the very latest news, which is that Pownal, Vermont, has also been affected, and PFOA has been found in elevated levels in water in Pownal. Howard, can you catch us up to speed on the latest there?
Yeah, well, this information came out last week, the positive water tests anyway did, that there's a company, Warren Wire, down in Pownal. What's interesting there is the man that started Warren Wire is also the same guy that started ChemFab up in North Bennington. And down in Pownal, Warren Wire made Teflon-coated electric wiring. And the factory there is right near a public water source. And soon after the North Bennington story broke, environmental and health officials in Vermont heard about Warren Wire, and they put it on their radar to check it. Those tests came back last week, and they're slightly elevated. Vermont has set its safe water limit at 20 parts per trillion. The tests in Pownal showed about between 25 and 27 parts, but nonetheless, they told people not to drink the water. They're handing out water, and there is a meeting in Pownal this evening at 6 p.m., which I plan to go to, where we're going to hear more. They're also down in Pownal starting to test some private wells in the area and soil and some of the other testing that they've had a week or two jump on in North Bennington.
Yeah, one of the differences between North Bennington's situation and Pownal is that, at least for now, what's being tested in Pownal is the public drinking supply. This is the single source that's going out to, I think it's what, about 450 households, Howard?
That's right, about 450 people, I think they're saying.
Ah. And so they are being advised now not to drink their public drinking water supply, and those private wells are being tested. So that's the update in Pownal. This extends the PFOA contamination to, as we said, a second community in Vermont. The first known one was North Bennington. But before that, the village of Hoosick Falls in New York began dealing with the issue of water contamination. So let's go back to where this story began, since people in the Bennington area really ramped up their effort to find out what was in their water supply, partly based on what they were learning from New York. Brendan, residents in Hoosick Falls were alerted to this contamination in 2015, but it was actually discovered in 2014?
That's correct. It was a resident, Michael Hickey. He's an insurance underwriter. He lost his father to kidney cancer in, I believe, 2013. And Michael just anecdotally observed what he thought was a high rate of cancer throughout the village. And one of his friends, a guy that he collaborated with on this effort, was Dr. Marcus Martinez, who was a local practitioner with a bustling practice. He's kind of the village doctor, if you will. He treats about 5,000 patients. He himself was diagnosed with atypical carcinoid, a very rare form of cancer. And so Michael began researching chemicals that were used at the various industrial, you know, small factories throughout the village. Initially, he didn't look for PFOA. He was thinking it might be something else, and then he stumbled upon PFOA, realized what it was, the history of it, its concerns in the Ohio Valley and West Virginia with being linked to cancer and thyroid diseases. And so Michael kind of began his own effort to bring this information to the village leaders, and he wanted to get the water tested. And initially, you know, according to Michael, there was some resistance. You know, there was a concern, you know, that it would upset village residents, that it would unravel this effort to revive Hoosick Falls, you know, in a project they call Hoosick Rising. And so in the early stages of this, there was a lot of closed-door discussions rather than notifying the public. And ultimately, Michael said that his efforts to get the village water were thwarted as well, because he was told that he wouldn't be allowed to have samples of the raw well water, the water in the wells that the village draws from before the treatment. So he went out to a couple businesses and some taps, including his own, drew his own samples and sent them to a Canadian laboratory, and bingo, they came back with levels of PFOA in them that were higher than what the EPA recommended for just short-term exposure. But then for months, and in fact for more than a year, you know, Michael was frustrated because it seemed that no one would sound the alarm in Hoosick Falls. It continued to be pushback from the state health department, you know, that would say that, you know, they would cite animal studies that arguably had been overwritten by more recent health studies that were done over a period of years involving tens of thousands of people in the Ohio Valley. And so what we did was, you know, we certainly there was some coverage, you know, there was some news coverage, but it didn't seem to get to the level of alarm that it needed to be. And then in December, we wrote a story on our front page on a Sunday that kind of outlined the whole history and raised questions about the handling of this. And that seemed to be the one story that kind of set the whole issue on fire in Hoosick Falls. You know, within days, the EPA, you know, demanded that the village warn residents. The state suddenly took an elevated interest in responding to the issue. And, you know, Michael, he still looks back and says, boy, that was the story that did it, you know, and he was grateful, I think.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today about PFOA contamination in several communities in North Bennington, now Pownal, Vermont, in Hoosick Falls, New York. It's also been found very recently in Merrimack, New Hampshire. And listeners, if you're in any of those communities, you can tell us what this experience has been like. and what questions remain for you and your family? Are you concerned about contamination in your water supply, whether you're on a public water supply or on a private well? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Brendan, from your experience reporting this story, it was the reluctance from local officials was mainly due to not wanting to cause concern, not wanting to maybe prevent people from thinking of Hoosick Falls as a good place to move and live. I mean, it sounds like the mayor has been one of the people dragging his heels on this in Hoosick.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, in his defense, he can hang his hat on the advice he's also getting at the same time from the state health department. You know, the state health department, we've seen, email chains from the state officials who would continue to give him the talking point that, you know, there's no adverse health effects from the levels of PFOA in the water. And that information is according to many people who were more deeply involved with PFOA and contamination, that information was just simply erroneous. You know, the first class action settlement or first class action trial in the DuPont case in Ohio last year was settled or actually went to a jury verdict. A woman who lost a kidney was paid $1.6 million, or at least that was the judgment. But that was someone who had exposure to levels of PFOA that were below the levels detected in Hoosick Falls water. And so, you know, I think that while the mayor may not have reacted the way residents wanted, at the same time, you know, he's being pulled in different directions behind the scene by the health officials who are telling him, you know, there's no concern here, nothing to worry about.
Yeah, and in fact, the EPA has said that the New York State Health Department and the mayor should have been telling people that this water is potentially dangerous, not saying it's a personal choice whether you want to drink it or not.
Correct. And then the EPA, of course, is now under fire because they, too, have failed to set, you know, a long-term exposure level for PFOA. It's an unregulated contaminant even for them. They have had an advisory since 2009, you know, of that greater than 400 parts per trillion, you know, which is short-term exposure. That would be weeks and months, not years. So other states have been much more aggressive. New Jersey set 40 parts per trillion years ago because of their concerns about PFOA contamination. I believe it's Ohio that may have a no detection level. You know, some states are taking the idea that, and maybe rightfully so, that there is no safe level of PFOA, you know.
Howard, how does this compare to what you're seeing from Vermont's health department and the situation in North Bennington and now in Pownal in terms of the way the state government and local officials are reacting to the news that PFOA is in the water supply?
Well, it was very different in Vermont right from the start, right from that very first when those tests came back. DEC Commissioner Alyssa Shurin and Governor Shumlin both said they got the first well test results back on a Thursday morning. They said they got the test back by 9 a.m. and they had called a press conference by 11. And that was after the first test. They tested six wells. Five of them came back positive. And the state's really been trying to be right out in front of it from the start. They're putting out these test results as quickly as they have them. They talked about the panel test. They released the panel test right away. Right now, the Department of Health is scrambling to get together these blood tests. And supposedly in some of the other states, the blood testing clinics, it's taken a couple of months to get together. And even though in Vermont it's still taken 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a month to get it together, they're saying that that's quicker than a lot of the other states. It's a pretty involved process. You have to have really specialized kits. All of the documentation has to be very strict and very accurate. So they're pulling that together. They're working with the CDC on that. So, yeah, Vermont's been out front. What's also interesting to look at is right now, DEC staff members are looking at maps, they're looking at old records, and they're kind of searching across the state for other companies that might have worked with PFOA in the past. So they're looking at other companies that might have worked in Teflon or Gore-Tex or stain-free carpeting or something. They're trying to overlay that on maps, and there could be more testing to come. We haven't heard any of that yet, but Commissioner Sharon has said that that's what the state is working on right now.
So speedy response once this was known, but, you know, as we heard at the top of the show from your reporting, Jim Goodine was among the people who were saying, I had concerns about the water supply, I had concerns about the manufacturing processes and if it could be contaminating us long ago. And, you know, I feel guilty that I wasn't more proactive in making sure the testing was there, but neither was the state.
Yeah, and what's interesting there is last week, Department of Environmental Conservation released all of the past documents from ChemFab, which went all the way back to the early 80s. And as
Brendan, just to remind people, ChemFab was the owner of the plant before it was bought by Saint-Gobain, who was the owner that shut it down in 2002.
That's right. ChemFab was established in 1968 by that same guy, John Cook, who started Warren Wire. John Cook started ChemFab in 1968. ChemFab operated up until 2000 as an independent company, and then in 2000, Saint-Gobain purchased it and closed down the plant in 2002. And what's come to light since then is kind of interesting, is one of the reasons that Saint-Gobain closed down the North Bennington plant is that Vermont was starting to crack down on them. And Vermont was requiring ChemFab to start putting on some scrubbers to cut down on some of the emissions. But going back to the original question, what Brendan pointed out, which is really important to keep mentioning, is that this was an unregulated chemical. So even though there were emissions and it was causing people's eyes to water and everything else, the PFOA, it was legal. What they were doing was legal. They were allowed to burn the stuff. They were allowed to send it up the emission stacks. And so that's where I think some of the frustration has come from the people who always talked about how awful the emissions were. And if you look at some of these documents that the DEC released last week, you can see that the state was trying to crack down on them, but it was all voluntary and they were working. There was a lot of very interesting reading back and forth between the company and the state. And the state was trying to get them to take some of these actions to cut down, but of course that would have cut into profits. And they did some things. They raised the smokestacks a little higher. They tried running some of the emissions kind of in the nighttime and things like that, but there were never any real serious steps taken to try to prevent this stuff from spreading.
We're talking today about PFOA contamination in several different communities within our listening area. And if you live in one of them, we'd love to know what you're thinking, how closely you're following this, or if you're affected. Do you live in Bennington or Rensselaer counties? Do you have questions about your own water supply, a public water supply, or a private well? Are you among those who are being tested by the state in Vermont with private wells? And is this something that concerns you if you live in other parts of the area? Do you think now about your water supply? I certainly think about my well water and how it's being tested and what might be in it. So I can see that this would be a concern for many people thinking about what's in our water and how do we find out and whose responsibility is it to know and to test. We're talking with two reporters who've spent a lot of time covering the stories in Hoosick Falls, New York, and in North Bennington, Vermont, and now in Pownall, Vermont, Howard Weiss Tisman for VPR and Brendan Lyons for the Times Union out of Albany. And if you have a question for them, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about blood testing, the company's response to this contamination in Hoosick Falls and in North Bennington, and what comes next for the water supplies. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. The extent of PFOA contamination in drinking water isn't known yet, and Vermont state officials say they're developing a plan to determine where water testing needs to be done. Here's Environmental Conservation Commissioner Alyssa Shuren speaking earlier this month.
We are taking a few people and looking into, okay, well, where are there other industries that may have created similar type products? You know, we're going to track down every lead, as well as we're going to work proactively to pull together a list of other industries where we might find these chemicals, and then we'll do some sampling in those areas as well.
David Bond is Associate Director of the Center for the Advancement of Public Action at Bennington College. He says the PFOA situation highlights the challenge of testing water for toxicity after small manufacturers have come and gone.
It's an impossible task. We need smarter maps. We need to sort of know how to focus our resources on where we suspect problems might be, and a better sort of regime of tests and questions for those sites in a focused way. We haven't done that up to this point. I think this is one of the things we're beginning to learn, is that, you know, figure out where PFOA was and begin to ask lots of questions around those sites.
We are talking today with Howard Weiss-Tisman, a reporter for VPR in southern Vermont, and Brendan Lyons, a senior writer for the Albany Times-Union assigned to the investigative team. They've been covering the PFOA contamination in Bennington County and Hoosick Falls, New York, respectively, and they're updating us on the situation in those communities as the story continues to develop. If you're living in any of these communities and you want to share a question or an experience of your own, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Brendan Lyons, Howard Weiss-Tisman was mentioning that, you know, there's upcoming blood testing. He's been doing some talking about that in his reporting in Vermont on residents in North Bennington who are concerned about the levels of PFOA in their blood. I understand that some residents in Hoosick Falls have already been tested. What did their blood tests show?
They haven't released those yet, to my knowledge. I know as of, I think, early last week, I had reached out to some residents who said that they submitted, you know, blood samples for testing, but have not heard back yet. I'm not sure why. I think part of it is that it's apparently a very complex blood test, so it might take some time to complete that work. You know, but stay tuned on that. It's apparently not as easy as testing for PFOA in the water stream.
In Vermont, the health department did take a look at what data they could out of Bennington to look for specific cancer clusters that might be associated with the contaminant PFOA. Has that been done in Hoosick Falls? Is there an official cancer cluster?
They are doing that work. The state health department is conducting, you know, an analysis of cancer rates. You know, one of the shortfalls of those reviews that they do is they're often based on zip code. You know, so you have an area like Hoosick Falls where the zip code extends well beyond the boundaries of the public water system. And so some scientists question, you know, the validity of those test results. But what we've seen in just examining you know, what data is available from the health department, it does appear that both Rensselaer County and Rensselaer and Bennington counties do have elevated levels of cancer in some instances. Now, whether that's a result of other variables, you know, it's unknown, but it'll be interesting to see what they determine in their long-term analysis. You know, Dr. Martinez, the physician, I believe, was doing some of his own research as well to see what he could show.
Although, Howard, we should point out that when we had the health department on this program now a week and a half or 2 weeks ago, they were saying that in Bennington itself and in, you know, in smaller amounts in North Bennington, but they have limited numbers to be able to check from, it didn't look like there was an official cancer cluster in North Bennington that could be attributed to PFOA contamination.
Right. But again, some of the Department of Health people said that there are challenges in that they're very kind of small sets of people they're looking at. And some of the same challenges Brendan talked about with zip code is also tricky in North Bennington, that some of the area of private wells, the way that cancer rates are determined, they're looking at much larger areas. So I think it was kind of a cursory study so far, and they're going to continue looking at that.
Let's go to the calls. Let's go to Chris in Williamstown. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to remind people in Vermont that Williamstown, Vermont, went through this. We had a UniFirst cleaning factory in our town, and it polluted both of our schools.
And, Chris, how was it dealt with? Were you satisfied with the response?
Well, a lady named Teresa Freeman and myself got an adult group together and fought against the state and finally got the wells tested. But if you've heard the horror stories about towns fighting these problems. All you have to do is look back and see what Williamstown went through.
What was the contaminant in Williamstown, Chris?
It was cleaning supplies used in dry cleaning plants. And it was ranging from many different chemicals they were using. For 20 years, they dumped it into the Stevens Branch River in Williamstown and Brookfield.
Chris, thank you for the reminder. I do remember that story now that you mentioned the dry cleaning contaminants. Thank you for reminding us of the fact that other towns have dealt with this as well. Let's go to Angus in North Bennington. Hi, Angus. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is sort of in line with both the health concerns and environmental concerns that seem to be pretty linked. Right now, the emergency seems to be about getting people onto clean water, but the actual issue is people's health. I talked to a farmer yesterday who just got tests done on groundwater, just basically sitting right on top of his fields, and it came back positive. So if it's in the soil, he is going to move. He has to move. This is a 90-year half-life, and there's really no recourse for him. So in thinking about, you know, what the two guests are talking about in terms of testing for PFOA in blood and all these things, the real issue and the much more expensive issue seems to be about health long-term.
Yeah, Angus, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. And we have heard from officials in North Bennington about that idea of testing soil, testing the sap in maple trees, you know, trying to see how widespread this contaminant is and where it is. And Howard, what about that? You know, the long-term implications for this, not just in the water supply or not just being able to use a filter to get PFOA out of a water supply, but all of the other places that it's potentially gone.
Yeah, there's a couple of points on that. One thing, the state is doing soil tests right now. That's kind of where they're at now. Most of, if not all of the private wells around North Bennington, I think, have been tested. And last week and this week, the state is going to be checking soil tests. Now, agriculture officials have said a couple things about that. A lot of what we're learning about with this PFOA is that there really is not a lot known about it. There have not been a lot of studies. There have not been a lot of long-term studies. So nobody really can say anything definitive about it. One thing that both a health and an agriculture specialists did say is that though there might be effects, it's a lot different than kind of consuming water on a daily basis. So they're not even sure if PFOA can be transferred from the soil to a zucchini or an eggplant or something like that. And they were even talking about the agriculture specialist was talking about looking at how different vegetables might react to it. But they did say that consuming vegetables, you know, local vegetables, which you just do a couple times a month, they certainly don't have the long-term effects of consuming water on a daily basis that might be contaminated. But they are looking at it.
Brendan Lyons, in terms of what's happening with specifically the water in Hoosick Falls, New York, what is happening to try to make sure that the water supply is clean for residents?
They have installed temporary filters at the water treatment plant in the village of Hoosick Falls, which serves roughly 3,500 customers as well as some commercial establishments. That they're doing continuing testing and flushing on the system. They haven't given the all clear yet, because one of the arguments has been, what is the acceptable level of PFOA in the finished product? The problem they have is that the stigma of the pollution has left, I think, people very wary of feeling safe to still consume the water that has PFOA in it that's being filtered out. You know, I mean, whether it's parents of newborn children or parents of any children for that matter, I think people are very reluctant to trust that water. There's been a push by residents to find an alternate source, you know, whether it be a different well field in the village, somewhere that's away from the plume that polluted this public system. Meanwhile, you have now PFOA being detected in private wells around the community, raising a whole other issue. And so the state is helping provide filter systems for those residents, I think, as quickly as they can. And it does appear from the pollution, the way it's sporadic and spread out throughout the community, that there's a very good chance that it was largely from the smokestacks. You know, that PFOA, according to the engineers we've spoken with, it's heavier than air. And people, longtime residents, you know, when these manufacturing facilities were going full bore, recall this kind of powder-like substance, they said, and it had a unique smell, and they would see it kind of settle in the valley on still nights. So,
well, and we should mention as well that the manufacturing plant site has been declared by the state a Superfund site, so there will be some cleanup of that actual area right there where the manufacturing took place.
Correct. That's going to be a years-long and very costly battle, you can bet.
You know, we got a message when you were talking about the question of people thinking, even if the filters are on my water supply, is it safe to drink? Chris in Middlebury says, well, we assume bottled water is pure, but where is it coming from? And is it tested for chemicals like PFOA? So, Brendan, I mean, there are questions about all of the water that we're drinking now.
It is. And, you know, there's companies throughout the country that it's become not a racket, but certainly, you know, you'll have companies that call themselves pure spring water that are simply drawing water from municipal water systems and then filtering it themselves. So the quote-unquote spring water that you drink in bottles very often is simply regular tap water that might be filtered one extra time.
Let's go to Michael, who's calling in from Newberry. Hi, Michael. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, as you stated earlier in the show, these pollutants come from the manufacturing process. They do not. Somebody physically does something to make them go into the environment. In the case of the pollen, and I'm learning today that it sounds like it's an airborne thing. Well, we have rules and laws in place, and people ignore putting scrubbers or other filters on those. You had a gentleman earlier talking about dry cleaning and cleaning solutions. We had one at Channel Mills in Bradford, Vermont years ago. And somebody, not through management, direct orders, but third shift or whatever, was being lazy and just dumping it out because it was quicker and easier. It's accepted practice. The select boards and towns get all excited when these little businesses come to town. It's tax dollars, tax revenue. But now it's costing the taxpayers a lot of money, and nobody's responsible. I want to know when and where people are going to start getting charged for polluting our environment.
Michael, thanks for the question. I appreciate that. And you know, just to clarify again, this issue, though, with the PFOA contamination in particular, this was an unregulated chemical. It was not regulated by the EPA. So putting it out into the environment was technically not illegal when this was being done. But Brendan, this goes to the question of who's going to pay and, you know, who gets charged, if anybody, for any criminal activities, and what happens in terms of paying for that cleanup?
Can I make a point, Jane?
Well, sure. Go ahead, Howard.
Yeah, one thing that a lot of people are talking about is the Toxic Substance Act, which hasn't been updated in a long time. That was a federal regulatory act going back to the 70s, and that's pretty much the gate, if you will, that allows a lot of these chemicals on the market. I've seen numbers as high as 80,000 chemicals have been released since the 60s and 70s. And there's a very, very low threshold for companies to prove that they're safe. And that's where a lot of people are saying that's where the work has to begin to regulate some of these chemicals.
And Brendan, to the point of, you know, what happens with Saint-Gobain, for example?
I think that while they're unregulated, there still is federal laws, you know, that prevent a company from engaging in this type of pollution. Now, whether it rises to criminality is another matter. I know the U.S. Attorney's Office in Albany has been monitoring this situation. They had an assistant U.S. attorney who went to some of the meetings to observe and see if there was some sort of case they could bring. I think to date that they have not decided on that issue. But in large part, you know, the EPA and, in this case, the state, which is trying to wrestle away the lead agency on this, on the Superfund site, they will have the ability to invoke that power to say to Saint-Gobain, you know, and Honeywell and any other predecessor companies that they can that are still active, they could say that you share in the cleanup costs. Whether or not it's unregulated, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't be forced to pay for the cleanup.
That's Brendan Lyons, a senior writer for the Times Union assigned to the investigative team. He's been covering the PFOA contamination in Hoosick Falls, New York. We've also been talking with Howard Weiss-Tisman, a reporter for VPR in southern Vermont, who's been covering the PFOA contamination in Bennington County. Brendan and Howard, thanks very much for talking with us today.
You bet. My pleasure.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, how to talk to your parents about drugs, their drugs. We'll look at the uncomfortable conversation that adult children sometimes need to have with elderly parents about prescription drug use and complications. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You've probably heard advice about talking to your kids about drugs. It may be an equally good idea to have a chat with your parents about the drugs they're taking. I'm talking prescription and over-the-counter medications, a common part of life for many older people. These drugs can be difficult to manage for seniors, especially if physical or neurological conditions worsen. And experts on aging say families need to learn to talk about this issue more openly, especially the middle-aged children of elderly parents. To fill us in on how to have these sometimes awkward conversations, we're joined now by Jessica Humphrey. She's a nurse and client care coordinator at Home Instead Senior Care in Shelburne, a franchise that offers in-home nursing and help for elderly people. Jessica Humphrey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Why is this conversation so difficult for so many adult children to have with their parents?
Well, I think that adult children of seniors are trying to be so respectful of their parents, and it's a tight rope that they're walking on in trying to be respectful and still have that relationship where their parents are their parents and they're the children, that they don't want to be offensive, but they really want to make sure that they are healthy and safe. So,
well, and we should point out not all parents are open to this idea that their kids are sort of prying around and maybe by assumption they think, well, my kids don't think I can manage my own medications.
Right. It's almost seen as offensive, and we have the conversations a lot in the home when we go in to say, well, the tides are kind of turning in that it's time for you to accept some help. This is a natural kind of occurrence of time for things to change, and it's okay, and start to have that conversation.
And what is the conversation that adult children are supposed to be having? Because, you know, if it's just what medications are you taking, then fine, you know something. But what are the concerns that we have about prescription medication and over-the-counter medication, and a lot of them maybe being taken at once?
Well, a few things happen as people age that just may make it a challenge, in that fine motor skills diminish, so even getting the pill bottles open, eyesight, so reading what it says, cognition changes, so understanding what those labels mean, cognition in that remembering when they're supposed to be taking them. So if you add on the aging aspects onto the fact that over 50% of our folks in North America that are 65 or over are taking over 4 or 5 medications, adding on a day,
wow,
adding on that factor, that there's, you know, the potential for, side effects or things, the kind of a cumulative effect, adding all those things together, there could be some issues. So,
and it's not safe to assume that a primary care physician would know and have oversight over all of the medications that a given patient is taking.
Right. That is the goal, and that's one of the things that's suggested in this toolkit that we're offering, is that there is a point person that is in control of the prescribing. And you do see that a lot more, that specialists may look to the primary care physician and say, I'm going to get this information to them, so that there's almost like a gatekeeper as far as who's prescribing the medication, so that they understand, or so that there's one person saying, oh, goodness, okay, you're on medication X. We don't do that with medication Y. We don't prescribe those two together. So looking to have one person coordinating the prescribing, or that there's one point person in the family that knows, okay, this is all the medications that are being taken. So because when they come from a bunch of different sources or are coming from a bunch of different pharmacies.
And may include over-the-counter medication, right, that a doctor might not, yeah, even know about.
Yeah.
So in terms of the awkwardness of the conversation and the difficulty that sometimes people have in starting that conversation with their family members, I mean, I don't know if you want to role play, but how would you suggest people do that?
So there are several different ways. And again, part of the Let's Talk About RX toolkit that Homestead Senior Care is promoting has several different suggestions, but something along the lines of, wow, I see you have several different medications here. Tell me how you manage to keep these all straight. So again, painting in that you assume that they're doing very well with it and let, you know, have them explain to you how they do it.
Yeah, wow, not what, coming from this, right, assumption that, oh, mom, you must,
there's
not
no
know
way
us.
You can handle, yeah, all this. So, you know, let, you know, tell me. Or I would imagine with all these prescriptions that you have, is there any, do you ever not feel good after you take them? So, because when you're working with elderly folks, sometimes if you don't give them an option, it's kind of like the open-ended conversation pieces. If you don't give them an option, they may just say yes or no, because with so much information coming at them, you really have to be skilled in knowing how to work and speak with somebody that you know, has maybe limited cognition or things like that. So
when do you recommend having these conversations? I mean, start before somebody's?
Start before there's a major issue happening.
But I mean, my parents are in their 60s and very healthy. I think they would be 60s and early 70s. I think they would be a little bit alarmed if I suddenly came to them and said, I want to know what's in your medicine cabinet.
I think more just saying, wow, you know, I talk with somebody on, I was talking to someone on my program, or someone that's a listener saying, I was listening to a program and it would be a really good idea if we just had an idea. Do you have a medication list somewhere? Or just having that conversation, or when someone is in the car or over at their parents' home, where do you keep all your prescriptions? Just work it into conversation, so it's not like a stare down at the dinner table.
So it's not too early to start, even when
it's
your parents are healthy.
It's never too early. That's the best time to start, when it's not a family emergency and you're trying to figure out, scramble, what is she taking? And
Jessica Humphrey is a nurse and client care coordinator, at Homestead Senior Care in Shelburne. Thank you for talking with us. We'll put a link up for people who want to know more information.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
This weekend, three states held Democratic presidential caucuses, so let us update you on where things stand in the race between former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii were the three Democratic contests, and all three went easily to Bernie Sanders. He had commanding wins of 73%, 82%, and 70%, respectively. NPR describes blockbuster turnout in all three states and a wave of passionate support for Sanders that helped propel him to those big wins. Now let me throw a couple more numbers at you. The delegate count. The Democrats count pledged delegates and unpledged delegates. That last group is often called superdelegates, and they can choose who they want to vote for. The pledged delegates reflect the vote totals in primaries and caucuses, and here is where those numbers stand after the weekend. According to NPR, Hillary Clinton leads with 1,243 pledged delegates. Bernie Sanders is at 975. Add in the superdelegates and Clinton lead grows substantially. There are still 22 primaries and more than 2,000 pledged delegates at stake between now and June when the final nominating votes will be cast. And speaking of numbers, in our roundup of March 15th primaries, I misspoke when I mentioned the pledged delegate count by including superdelegates in the number that I gave. We regret that error, but we do appreciate the keen ear of a listener who heard the mistake and followed up. We encourage you to follow up, too. We've posted NPR's delegate tracker on our Facebook page. Read the numbers and give us your thoughts on how the race between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton is unfolding. The so-called cancer moonshot being led by Vice President Joe Biden would pump more federal money into efforts researching cures for cancer. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll check in on some of the cutting-edge cancer research going on in our neck of the woods. Post your questions or comments about cancer research at vpr.net or email vermontedition@vpr.net. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.